All right, let's start the afternoon session now. We're going to look at, and this is really our first full discussion, having decided to take this item onto our agenda, looking at another DIES 16 possible interpretive project dealing with the contingent pricing of PP&E and perhaps also to intangible assets. So, Fabienne?
So, turning on to H in the paper 4, the committee received a request asking for guidance on how to account for contingent payments agreed for separate purchase of PP&E or intangible assets. At its meeting in January, the committee decided to take the issue onto its agenda. In January, the committee directed staff to provide background information for discussing the scope of the project and alternatives for the accounting for contingent prices for the purchase of a single item of PPE. The staff performed outreach activities and received feedback from interested parties. The examples provided confirmed that there is that the issue is widespread and industry-wise. Turning to scope. Through the practical examples received, the staff highlighted some characteristics of contingent prices. These are described in paragraphs 19 to 31 of the paper. The analysis focuses on whether the contingent price has an effect on the cost of the asset. The staff believe a distinction exists between the cost of the asset at the time of its acquisition and the increase in the value of the asset brought by the additional payment. The staff think that a contingent price that is to be recognized after the asset is ready for intended use and is based, for example, on future performance or usage reflects the value of the asset rather than its cost. The staff note that the value of the asset after recognition is not reflected in the cost model in IFRS's. The staff identified and discussed in paragraph 32 to 45 of the paper common indicators for contingent prices within the scope of the project. Those contingent prices are not representative of compensation for the provision of further goods or services. They are set for the outright purchase of an asset rather than the purchase of the right to use an asset. They are recognized between the date the asset is recognized at the time of purchase and the time it is ready for its intended use. The contingent price is specific to the asset. It is arising for agreements to purchase items accounted for in accordance with the COTS model, and it's giving rise to a financial instrument. So, turning to the questions to you, do you agree that the proposed indicators outline efficiently the scope of the project?
Yep, thank you. All right, responses for Fabienne? Guido?
The question relates to the scope of the project. I have especially a problem with 48C because I think that actually whether the costs have been incurred between the date as it is recognized and intended for its use doesn't really matter in this situation, so I would not scope that out. I think that a company could easily influence the costs that can be capitalized by just prolonging the time period to get an asset for its intended use. So, for instance, if there is contingent consideration that is based on usage or performance or whatever, or of another index, or so I would not agree with 48C. I think we should that should be part of the interpretation itself, but not part of the scope. For the other points in 48C, I would agree. But I think that we should keep in mind that some of these things might be part of the interpretation itself and should not be part of the scope. So maybe in the process of the discussion, we might come up with a different view that it should not be part of the scope out, but part of the definition of contingent consideration or part of the decision whether it will be capitalized or expensed.
Yeah, I want to echo Guido's comments there. I think when I look at this issue, to me, it can be extended broadly out to IP transactions, etc. I really think this scope is trying to distinguish, in my opinion, kind of deferred cost or deferred payments from kind of future operating costs. And I think when you put in paragraph C, which is to say we're going to show a bright line, I think you run into a point where maybe someone has just deferred payments, and that would be then subject to future, expensing as opposed to capitalization. And I'll just use a simple example whereby, and again, in the IP industry a lot, you may come to an agreement that, between us, that the IP is worth 400. We agree it's worth 400, but you don't have the cash on hand to pay me. You'll have the cash as you produce the product that uses the IP. And so we'll agree that over a certain amount of time, you will give me the 400. And again, I know in the farm industry, a lot of different iterations of that. I wouldn't say the cost isn't 400. It's not free because that IP or that patent may be ready for use. But it's more just a deferred payment term. And that's why I think in the scope, to Gita's point, I think C is more in the interpretation as opposed to distinguishing. I think as well on this one, need to be careful too on things like reversion rights, those things that are very common in the IP industry. If you're going to hand over IP to someone and rely on them to take it to the next step, and if they decide to stop for whatever reason, you usually protect yourself by being able to recapture it back. So I think there's a lot of things, at least in the scope here, that need to be considered in those two areas.
Okay, so I suppose the part of the tension is coming on how we use the term incurred, because if there is no obligation, or if the obligation is one that could be avoided by the counterparty, then I think it's this sort of legal right or legal entitlement, legal obligation, as opposed to just the mere timing of the payment that takes place for convenience. But I hear your concerns. So it's not that we're going to exclude this entirely. It's just that we might address it in a different part of the interpretation rather than putting it into the scope itself. Okay, well, let's keep going then. Joanna?
Well, I've just put my light on really to comment on what Guido and Aaron have said, because I read what Fabienne has written here is, if you like, limiting it. And it may be that the words are wrong, and that it's, to me, absolutely out of scope is deferred payments. And maybe we haven't got that clearly articulated in here. But to me, C actually is very important, because that is the scope within 16 that effectively, which is what we're trying to deal with, that allows you to capitalize a cost, because it basically says, forget any contingent prices or anything, it says you're allowed to capitalize until you get to the ready for intended use. And therefore, I see what Fabienne is trying to do here is to limit it to that point in time, and from their very original acquisition date, if you like. So it's only up to that point in time, as opposed to, I think, what you two are worried about is that this is opening it up. So I think the concept of what Fabienne is trying to do is right, and maybe the words aren't there. So I disagree with you two, I think, in terms of, I think C is incredibly important, that intended use date, because that's where 16 goes to.
Laurence?
I do have problems with the way the scope is being proposed. When I was looking at, in fact, what would be captured, I'm thinking it's not capturing many of the elements for which we have an issue about how to account for contingency in the price. With some of the elements in the document that may influence saying that once you are not in, everything should go into P&L. In addition, with the paragraph 48C that has been mentioned by Guido and Aaron, I disagree that this is a triggering event for, or the cutoff for identifying whether it's part of the cost of the asset or not part of the cost of the asset. I do believe that in some circumstances, operations later on, sales, performance, whatsoever, may enable to understand the intrinsic nature of what you have purchased. And so that a payment that is triggered by this is in effect an element of the cost. To give you an illustration, say I buy a painting. The seller is saying to me, this is a Van Gogh. Myself, I think, yes, perhaps it is a Van Gogh, but I'm not sure. So there will be an expertise, and depending on the expertise, I will pay the seller an additional price if there is confirmation that it is a Van Gogh. That painting, I put it in my entry of, I have a head office, big head office, because it's nice and possibly it's a Van Gogh, or if it is not a Van Gogh, it will be an imitation of a Van Gogh, but it will sit well in my entry. So it is ready for use. I'm going to use it. I have paid 100 at the moment, but if the expert confirms that it is actually Van Gogh, I will pay an additional 900. And I do believe that in that case, the additional 900 I pay, because I have confirmation it is a Van Gogh, is actually part of the cost of the item I have purchased. So this is why I do believe that certain indicators subsequent to the item being ready for use can in fact reveal the nature of the item that has been purchased, and so should form part of the cost of the item that is being purchased. And so this is why I would not draw a line here. Finally, I am also very worried about the direction, if we go along that line for the scope, with the ramification of various other elements that are proposed to be scoped out, and the consistency of the answers we will have with the other elements. I'm thinking about assets used in mining industry. I'm thinking about concession assets arising under IFRIC 12. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of associates. I'm thinking, I have a whole list inventory, as it was mention how to account for discounts and rebates. So I'm really worried about the scope and the ramification with other items.
You must be exhausted doing all that thinking, Laurence.
I have plenty of energy.
Innovative suggestions as an example of PP&E is a painting by an old master. I think, again, as I observed to Guido, part of the concern in 48C really is whether or not the cost has been incurred, because without having all the details, of course, it would seem to me that in the case of buying the painting, and there's a contingency on there that you will pay the additional 900, and I wish that's all you had to pay, but you have to pay the additional 900 if the fact that it is what it was asserted to be is confirmed by an expert, that you have actually incurred that expenditure. You haven't made the expenditure at that time. So you've incurred a liability that you cannot avoid payment on, which will be different from saying that I will pay you the 900 if I decide to call in an expert who confirms, in which case you don't call in an expert. So it's like the reversionary rights. So I think that we're sort of dancing on a pinhead here a little bit as to what we actually have as a liability. I mean, we shouldn't forget that although we're dealing with the cost of an asset, there's also this other consideration at the back, which is, do you have a liability that you have to recognize under IS 39? And if there's a liability you have to recognize, and 39 doesn't just deal with confirmed absolute amounts, it deals with uncertain amounts, but if you have that obligation to make that payment, then I would say that you are already obliged, and therefore that liability is in here. It's a subsequent event that will confirm the amount or whether, in fact, you have to pay it in the future. But anyway, we'll take some more comments because this paragraph is obviously causing a bit of concern. Ruth?
Yes, I had a similar concern about 48C and the lead-up in the rationale to it, but I think you've just hit the nail on the head in terms of how to address this problem. Which comes first, the asset or the liability? You started from the asset side, but if you start from the liability side, you might come up with a different answer because, as you say, you might have an obligation, whether financial or not. And then if you do have an obligation, but it's nothing to do with whether or not the asset is ready for use, does that mean you don't have an asset? And I would have thought the way to look at it, if we are going to look at it separately from the asset side and then from the liability side, is to look at the definition of the cost of an asset in IS 16, which says it's the amount of cash or cash equivalents paid or the fair value of the other consideration. And if we look at it in terms of the fair value of the consideration, then we would be allowed to bring in an estimate of that contingency, which I think might better fit with figuring out if I've got the liability as well. And we'd get closer to an IFRS 3 type of analogy, which would allow me to bring in an estimate of that contingency into the cost of the asset if I have the liability. So you have to look at the two together. But I think that might be a bit better way to go, because what worries me about 48C is that I couldn't imagine hardly any contingent price that would be allowed to be debited to the asset. To me, it seems very, very restrictive, and you wouldn't be able to get anything in there unless I'm completely misreading the way you've written it. So I would have thought the way to attack it from the asset side is to say, should this contingent amount be included in my estimate of the fair value of the consideration?
Yeah, bearing in mind, Ruth, I think that many people have said, and that's why Laurence's example is actually a very good one, that to determine a fair value of the other consideration, the promise to pay, if somebody confirms something which is not a regular, predictable type of event, that the difficulty you then have in determining the fair value pricing, I think another way of saying what Laurence was saying is that contingent pricing arrangements often come about not only for cash flow reasons, but they arise because of the difficulty of putting a value on something now that is fair to both sides because of the range of uncertainty that exists. But
the other thing that worries me about it is when you limit the way your rationale was going, you end up having to limit it only to assets that are measured at cost, only to assets that are purchased outright, can't apply to revalued assets, can't be applied to assets that are licenses, for example. And it left me thinking, then it doesn't seem as if this principle works because it has to be so limited to such limited circumstances.
Is it that it's limited or that it just isn't relevant? That if you're dealing in a fair value world with the asset itself, Laurence's example, we'll stick with that, the fair value of the painting itself is more than the 100 that's been paid for it, but it's less than the 1,000, which might be the maximum you've got to pay for it. It's something in between. If you're looking at it on a fair value basis, once that contingency has been determined, that it is in fact an old master, then its value would appreciate. Now, whether its value would appreciate beyond 1,000 depends on what the market for those certified items is, but it then goes beyond the contractual cost-based agreement. So the uncertain event creates both value as well as creating the trigger for the payment. So whether you deal with that payment as being part of the cost of the asset, I'd say it's not relevant going forward because you're looking at it on a fair value basis. So I think the reason for the scope exclusion was not that the principle doesn't work, but that the principle isn't necessary in a revaluation or fair value world.
Fair enough, but I think the day one measurement should be the same, because if cost equals fair value on day one, then okay, we diverge on subsequent measurement.
All right, Scott?
I had some of the same, or some concerns around the same words regarding 48C, although, Bob, as you pointed out, I thought that the issue was really the word incurred, and that a large portion of what we're likely to have differences in view about is exactly when the contingent cost is incurred. I think in Laurence's example, I would have said it was incurred when you signed the contract because you had to record the liability. I think that's clear because it's not in your control. I presume that the seller in that case would require the expert to come in versus allowing the buyer to have the option of having an expert come in. So there I think that as we read on in the paper, we would have said that the liability exists when you sign the contract, and I think that the word incurred is meant to be to encompass not just when you make the payment, but indeed when you need to record the liability. Where I started to have problems was actually when I moved on and realized the conclusion that the staff was suggesting that a cost is not incurred if the future event is within the purchaser's control until that event happens. I kind of thought that you actually incur a liability when you agree to pay somebody 3% of your future sales, not just when you actually go out and have those future sales. And so the way I was thinking about the word incurred, I thought the scope was pretty good. And then I kept reading and thought, I think I've missed something. That's where I got a bit confused. But I kind of like, conceptually, the cutoff of ready for intended use. If you haven't incurred the cost by the time the asset is ready for its intended use, then, yeah, it feels bad to me to say that it's part of the cost of the asset. But, these sales-based contingencies and the like, I think the liability to make those is indeed incurred when you sign the contract. So that's where I started having differences. That's peeking ahead, but it was when I peeked ahead that I started to have concerns about that scoping.
That's why it's always dangerous to peek ahead, isn't it, Scott?
Indeed.
John Levy?
I have the same difficulty with I have a question about the right of use in the paragraph B, because I understand we want to limit the scope, but I don't really see a conceptual reason to exclude them. And as far as paragraph C of question 48 is concerned, I have also examples where I don't know exactly what will be the answer, different from Laurence. The case I've seen of a telecom company buying a satellite, and part of the price is fixed, and then another part of the price is contingent to the fact that the launch of the satellite has been successful, and the other part is dependent on the fact that the performance is okay, I mean, emitting the right message from the satellite as to be used during a specific period as a telecom satellite. So I don't know what would be the deadline or the time we should consider that I have the cost is incurred between the asset is ready for its intended. What is the limit in that type of situation? So I think that to come back to the initial comment made by Guido, I think this is really the part, one very substantial part of potential interpretation, and we should not at this stage limit the scope, because this is a matter we should be discussed in more detail.
Dornley, I think we do have to limit the scope. Otherwise, it becomes such a big, yeah, wide-ranging project, we have a difficulty. I thought one of the reasons, Fabienne, that we would restrict right of use in here is because there is, in fact, a current project that the board has called leasing, which is dealing with rights of use, because that has its own rules, which are different from IS 39, which is in part where this problem arose, that we wouldn't want to deal with two different situations and try and come up with the same result. Would that be right?
Yes.
Okay. But here the concerns about the other projects. TAC, if we can bring you in now.
Yes. I was wondering whether which is the real target of this draft interpretation, whether we would like to define the liability, especially when, or whether we define the asset side, cost of assets. So which is the main target? That is the point. As long as I understand, because we had a discussion in January, we discussed the case when the buyer has the control on the contingent event. Then I thought that is the main discussing point. If that is the main discussing point, the approach in your draft would be a little bit confusing, because you start with asset side, as Bruce pointed out, and you talk about the case of liability when the buyer has a control, but in the end, in the conclusion, it is not too clear the interaction between the such case and your interpretation draft. So if you would like to focus on the liability side, and if you focus on the case when the buyer has a control, it should be the agenda paper should be to start with liability side.
It's an interesting approach, of course, TAC, because the question that we're asked is whether or not these contingent components are included in the cost of the asset. So we have to focus on the asset. And as we've observed, of course, then there's the other parallel run, which is that you may have a liability and you're not quite sure what the debit entry of that liability is, whether it's to expense or whether it's to the cost of the asset. So I think we have to focus on the asset in order to be able to answer the question of both the liability and the asset. That will tell us what cost should be included, and therefore, by inference, which one should be excluded. But knowing that there is a liability, I think, helps us in some respects to know that we should be recognizing something for the cost. And that's why I would read 48C on the positive side, say, accepting that there may be a negative side, saying that if you have already incurred a liability for something, even if it's only a contingency, and therefore it's not at the full amount, it's not at the gross amount, it's at a current value type amount, that amount of the liability, together with the other costs that have already been expended, are part of the cost of the asset, provided it's not yet ready for use. And then we go on, there are a number of other factors here to determine what is within the scope. So I think we've got to get these two thoughts running through our minds, but this is not an interpretation of, I have a financial liability under IS 39, can I not account for it because I'm not sure what the answer is, and can I only account for it when I'm absolutely sure what the cash payment is going to be, because I don't think that's the question that was asked, and that's not the one we're going to resolve. Let's keep going on, Andrew.
To be honest, I'm not sure I would have come at it from the angle of ready for intended use in terms of the scoping. I think we have two key issues here, and trying to bridge the gap between asset and liability. The first issue is, if you have a contingency outside your control when you sign the contract, you have a financial liability. The big issue is, what do you do with the subsequent remeasurement? That's what people don't like, taking the subsequent movement to P&L rather than asset. If the standards give us no other option, then maybe we should just say so. The other question is where you've got a contingency that's outside your control, within your control, within the purchase control, and therefore you don't book it on day one, or there's a very good argument for not booking it on day one. Does that have any impact on the day one fair value of the asset, using the words in the standard that Ruth quoted? So you could kind of end up in some sort of asymmetrical position where it goes into the asset number, but it's not a liability, so if you don't book it. That, to me, those are the two issues, and this really for intended use, I thought, just kind of muddied the waters a bit.
Don't you think that ready for intended use helps you to understand the timing of this in some way? That 16 talks about that you do capitalize assets until that point at which it is ready for its intended use, and therefore costs that have been incurred prior to that date are included in the asset. That's the clear-cut interpretation of 16. Costs that are incurred subsequently then are not part of that asset, unless they, like deferred stripping, contribute to a betterment or something else, that is, some improvement of the asset. So normal I-16 rules for subsequent expenditure. I think we're just trying to get a clearer understanding of why the relevance of under my control or not under my control.
But what would you do if, I was just thinking aloud now, you bought an asset that's an office that's ready for use.
Mm-hmm.
And you agree that if I apply for planning permission for some other use, and if I get planning permission, I'll give the vendor a bit more money. How does that second payment factor into this principle? It's ready for use now,
yeah.
So you're going to pay more if it's a different use.
Well, good.
I mean, to me, the second payment would be a debit to the asset, but quite sure how it fits in. Maybe it does, but I wasn't sure how it fitted into this.
Well, yeah. This is a cost accumulation approach. If you do something that increases the value of the asset, then you can...
That's not what that says, though.
But this is the scope of this project. This isn't saying you can't debit that to the asset. That is...
It's all right. You weren't on air, so nobody's listening to you. Would you like to participate, Joanna?
I was just going to... Sorry. But that doesn't preclude you doing what you're doing. This is all that Fabienne is doing, is trying to limit very clearly what we are doing in this particular interpretation. It doesn't mean... It's not saying you don't follow 16 when you've got some cost that adds value or benefit to your asset. You would capitalise that.
Does that mean therefore,
or consider capital arm, and you would do whatever 16 says to do with it?
Well, we must be careful that we don't go too far off the point on this one. But Laurence, you were anxious to get back in.
Yes, it was on the comment made on the justification for the exclusion of the right to use assets. I had understood that under the leasing project, you would recognize an asset and a liability with the premise that it is not an executory contract. So it did not matter that you had a continuing performance of the seller over the life of the agreement. And so if it was considered that under leases you were not in an executory contract, so you have an asset and liability, what's the difference with what we are looking at? And so I don't understand the justification for excluding right-of-use assets. And so this is why I come back again to say I'm afraid that by limiting the scope too narrowly, I'm afraid that we will come to some conclusions that may conflict with other areas that are very similar. And for me, this issue about contingent prices in purchasing an asset that falls under the cost model is a very broad one that needs to be looked at broadly. And I'm not even sure that it is within the remit of the Interpretation Committee to look at this issue. I know that my U.S. colleagues have been telling me that the FASB is currently conducting research on purchases with contingent prices on a very comprehensively basis. So I'm really worried if we're just looking at tiny
range of items without having a complete picture and making sure that we will not create inconsistencies.
So are you suggesting we take it off the agenda?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Sarah?
I don't think I want to take this off the agenda. So I back to Andrew's point about what to do with the cost for the zoning or whatnot. I think paragraph 20 of IS 16 kind of tells you what to do, because it says you recognize the cost. It actually says cease recognizing the cost once you get the asset in the location and condition necessary for it to be capable of operating in the manner intended by management. Well, if management's intent was to develop, but in order to develop you have to have the zoning, you wouldn't be able to get to that. Well, I think paragraph 20 of IS 16 tells you what to do. I think the question that Fabienne's trying to address in this interpretation is, what about those costs that, carrying on with the real estate development, you have a parcel of land, you have zoning, so you can develop, but the question is, the contingent payment is you will get paid more depending on the number of units, the seller will get paid more depending on the number of units that are developed. And that's the kind of question I think that we're trying to address, and I think that's what Fabian's trying to address in all of the paragraphs leading up to 48. So I think we might add value with doing an interpretation here to help with those kind of questions, where we're going to start with the basis and the principle in IAS 16 and these other ancillary paragraphs like 20 and carry on from there. So I think maybe we could add value.
Well, again, I'm wary of trying to broaden this too much. If it's for real estate developers, then their interest is actually not in developing PP&E for the long term.
Right.
They make the additional payment because they've developed additional units on that property, which they're selling.
Right.
Then I think that takes care of it. But we've heard before that there are lots of contingent payments.
Right.
The question is, which are the ones that are of most concern? I think Andrew's pointed out this real concern is actually what goes into P&L,
right.
What goes into the cost of the asset.
Exactly.
But we'll get back to that in a moment. Fei Long.
Yeah. I'll make a comment to this, Scott. I know that inventory at current stage was excluded by the staff. But I really think that this should be included in some industry, especially like mining and oil and gas industry. The sales price usually was determined by the future index. So this is all to be included.
So those would be for purchases of the material, the basic material,
yeah.
But the price of that would be contingent on something later.
Yeah.
Okay. Fabienne, I can see, is thinking she's going to lose all her weekends now in dealing with this broadened scope. So that just brings us back. Final round, Guido.
Yeah, I'm also of the view that we should broaden the scope, and then going along, maybe we can see whether we have to restrict the scope. What worried me was really paragraph 51 in the staff paper that seems to imply that everything that falls in the scope that is outlined in 48 should be part of the cost. I think that is the interpretation we are looking for. So that was really the problem that I had with everything that falls within the scope is part of the cost.
So I realize paragraph 51 is beyond the question that we're actually dealing with at the moment. But.
Well, no, but it really adds to the argument that it seemed to a lot of the members of the committee that 48 really tries to give you the answer. So as long as you are within the scope, with all these scope outs, everything is then capitalized as cost. that seems to be what paragraph 51 implies. But I don't want to. I mean, I'm really, the way I would address this issue is, yes, we should restrict it somehow. So I can understand that people say, let's restrict it to the acquisition of tangibles and intangibles, not inventory, for instance. I can understand that that might be too broad. Then go on with defining what is contingent consideration, and we may build on what IFRS 3 says, because that's everything that's paid to the seller. And then the next step would be how do we define costs? So we would have to look at IS 16, and there are some questions that need to be answered. For instance, costs incurred as at the acquisition day. What does that mean? Does that mean that only if I have a liability that I cannot avoid to pay, is that cost incurred as at the acquisition date? Or are all munis or everything that I pay to the seller, are these costs, even though it might be, the liability might be recognized after the transaction date. So I think if we could come to a conclusion there, that would be a principle-based interpretation, which is narrow enough that we could deal with it and not too broad. But, you know, with this scope
of... You may have forgotten the way that we've developed interpretations before, but we try and develop the interpretation with a narrow scope where we can come to a conclusion that is applicable without exceptions and then consider other circumstances. So what we may be saying is something that answers a series of questions that are of concern, but not all of the questions that are of concern. And then by analogy, can people use the basis of what we've done to broaden that to other items? I warn you, if we put the scope too wide, that we will not be in a position where we can reach a consensus within a reasonable period of time, because there'll be too many issues to consider, and then we help nobody, least of all ourselves. If we can focus, and I think Fabienne's idea in trying to say, let's restrict in paragraph 48 to certain characteristics and certain types of items. The other points you've mentioned we will need to address as we're going through. That's a later stage to the scope. But if we can come up with a conclusion, and again, I think Fabienne's intention is that if we can come up with one solution to all of the items that are contained within the scope described in paragraph 48, then that gives us a better basis for seeing where we can then take it beyond, which other items can be included within that scope, and also where there are other points of tension which are not addressed with this. So, but let's take some more comments. Jean, you...
Yeah, I was going to say on the scope issue, I wonder if we should take the scope. When I look at the criteria 48, for sure it's the outright purchase of an asset. And I think the question is what comes into the cost. So it's back to what Guido says, whether we should interpret what cost means and avoid getting into recognition of the liability. Just deem there's a liability. Maybe we need to identify what it means by an liability incurred as a result of the outright purchase of the asset, but not the measurement of the liability. Leave that aside, so we avoid, you know, having to define whether a liability should be recognized or not. IS 39 is there for that. So I would try to walk away from any issues of measurement of liability. Just define what comes into the scope of the cost under IS 16 in an outright purchase of an asset. And if you take this angle, for example, 48D would be the answer, as opposed to I kind of give the answer by my scoping of the project. I think you can have a wider scope, but a specific fact pattern, and then as you define what can be included in the cost, then you would have to say the cost has to be specific to the asset and then try to define that. But I think if we do that and we walk away from this issues of the liability on the liability side, because I'm not sure that the question arises on the liability side, how to measure the liability, I'm not sure we should get there. And that's the difficulty I hear around the table, that if you start to try to define whether the liability should be recognized in the following fact patterns. When is the liability recognized, irrespective of when it's recognized? If it's incurred and it's directly related to the asset, then does it go in the cost of the asset or not? Then maybe you can get to the conclusion simply by defining what IS 16 means with cost. So that would be a way to scope the project. Not, you know, in a way, it's not so narrow that, you know, you're trying to have zillions of restriction on what you're trying to define. But the scope would be the outright purchase of an asset under IS 16, for instance, but just limited to the definition of what is the cost. Not try to solve issues of measurement of a contingent liability.
I think we are trying to answer what are the elements of the cost, and we've got to decide for which items do we have to answer that question. Luca, you want to join in?
Oh, yes, thanks. I agree what Guido and John said. I think that the real issue is to look at what is the definition of cost and work on this, and even though it's clear that we have to work with a narrow scope, I think that the item is so wide that we will necessarily be forced to have a wider scope to look at, because otherwise we will make a very strange interpretation with the specific elements, but referring to an element that is the cost, and in general the cost model that collects not only PP&E but also many other elements of a financial statement. So what you have said is correct. There is the risk that we will not be able to reach a consensus on a timely basis, but I think that we have to take this risk, because I don't think that we will be able to define a so narrow scope, because otherwise we will determine something that could be useless and difficult to manage due to the tentative to use its interpretation by analogy.
All right. Rather than keeping on going around the table, what I'm going to suggest from what I'm hearing is that you disagree with the indicators that the staff has put down to describe the scope, and the trend seems to be that you want to be broader rather than narrower, and therefore, if we're going to start focusing on issues like what is the cost of an item, which will include necessarily what can be included in the cost of an item, measured under IS 16 or under IS 38, then we don't need to look at the scope anymore. We don't need to spend any more time in looking at the indicators. We can then move on to the accounting questions. These same issues will come back to us again, because they're going to arise again, but in a different area, not in the scope. So, shall we move on, or do you want to make some more comments on this? Andrew?
Well, I don't think we should abandon this yet, but I think you can get to the nub of all the issues we're trying to discuss by looking at the PP&E example. I think it's right to start narrow and broaden out. I agree we should end up with a broader solution, but the PP&E example, or the painting example, to me focuses on all the key issues, and what we should be considering is what do you do with payments that are outside the purchaser's control, payments that are within the purchaser's control, and payments that are based on future performance. And you can do that with a piece of PP&E and then think about how to apply it to other issues.
Sorry, can I just make one last comment? I'm really worried that we're focusing on a cost of an asset. We're looking at IS 16. My understanding as to why this came to us was because effectively people were saying that if you've got a liability when you first recognise your asset, oh shit, I've got to, sorry, and I will say that, I've got to go to 39, which means I've got to, when it changes in value, I've got to take that through the P&L, and I can't affect my asset. And that is the issue. I don't believe the issue is what is interpretation of IS 16. And yes, I am peeking ahead, and Fabienne, I mean, and that is very clear. The standard is extraordinary. The two standards are extraordinarily clear. There is no interpretation. That you work out what your asset is under 30, under 16. If you have a liability and it's a financial liability, it's under 39, and oh, the volatility goes through the P&L. It was brought to us because people don't necessarily like taking that volatility to the P&L. Fabienne is suggesting at the end of all this that even with the narrow scope or the wide scope or whatever, but if you start with the narrow scope, that it still goes to P&L. She's saying we're stuck with 39. If we want to interpret, we have no choice. 39 is it. So I'm just worried that we're spending all this time thinking about the scope and about an asset when actually that wasn't the... I don't recall that that was actually the question that we're dealing with. The question is, when I have a liability when I buy an asset, I don't like it going to the P&L. Please, can you fix it?
You want to keep talking on this, Guido?
Yes.
Ruth? Okay.
Just along the same lines of Andrew and Joanna, I think we're wasting a lot of time focusing on scope and on whether or not something's included in the cost of the asset. That wasn't really the question. We're not really worried about the initial entry. People seem to be comfortable that if they've got a liability, they know that they can put the debit to the asset. And it seems to me the paper's spending a lot of time focusing on that, where the real issue is when I subsequently, two issues, if I have a financial liability, if I subsequently remeasure it, must I take the hit to P&L? Or if I don't have a financial liability, I'm not sure if I've got a liability, when do I need to book it? And then once I have booked it, where do I take the movement? And that's why initially we said, should we analogise to IFRS 3 or should we analogise to IFRIC 1? And to me, that's where we should be spending our energy. The other point I just wanted to make quickly was that in IAS 16, the definition of cost, apart from the fact that it talks about fair value, this is on page 25 of the staff paper, the extract from B2 has little 16C added, which says the initial estimate of the costs of dismantling and removing the item, et cetera, et cetera, is specifically put in there to say you can put that initial estimate in the cost. I can't read it at the moment. But presumably that came in as a result of IFRIC 1, that being put in there. But that could be something that we could do. If necessary, we could specifically say your cost can include your initial estimate of contingent consideration. If we decide that we'd like to create some exception and allow the subsequent movement to go to the cost, we could recommend to the board to put in little 16D to say, and the subsequent movement, if we decide we want to do that, or otherwise we may decide not to do that and say, if it's a financial liability, too bad, it goes to P&L. But I think that's
what we need. That's the next phase of the paper to go on through there. But that IFRIC 1 issue is because the obligation is not a financial liability under IAS 39, and so the accounting canon is different. I would have thought the situation that had arisen here had arisen primarily because people previously were analogizing to the IFRS 3 predecessor, accounting for contingent consideration, because there was no application guidance in IAS 16, and were accounting for that on the basis that if the amount was so uncertain that I can't determine reliably what that liability is, I don't book a liability. I only book the amount when the contingency takes place later, and then I adjust the amount of the asset. That's what people were doing. And then, wisely or otherwise, Alan and his colleagues then changed IFRS 3 and said, now for contingent consideration, because you are measuring all of your assets and liabilities at their fair value anyway, different from IAS 16, which is a cost-based approach, that you will now take the contingent consideration, you will make an estimate of it, the liability, and any change that subsequently arises, because it only affects the recorded amount of goodwill, which is a residual haphazard asset anyway, that you'll book that difference to profit and loss. So the analogy that people were using before to determine how to account for this, for those items of contingent consideration that were not being recognized as a liability, has now changed. And it's changed to a way that they can't see why their accounting for a PP&E asset has changed, because the goodwill accounting has changed under a business combination. And I thought that was the concern. If somebody has previously recorded that liability, I'm assuming that they've not only read 16, they've also read 39, and they know how to deal with changes in that liability. And therefore, that wasn't the issue. I thought the issue was not recognizing something that was there before by analogy to another standard that implied they didn't need to recognize it. And now they're left with no choice. Yes, IFRS 3 is clear what you do. Yes, IS 39 is clear what you do. But the answer is not particularly comfortable for people that were doing something else. Do you want to continue talking about scope for a bit longer, or do you want to move on to the next part of the question? And particularly as you think we shouldn't be even taking this on as an interpretive issue, although you gave us a very good example to begin with. Guido?
Well, I would have liked to stay with the scope, but there have been so many committee members that talked about one of the issues that were not even included in the agenda paper, that is, how do you recognize changes in the liability? I'm not so sure that IS 39 is clear. Yes, maybe IS 39 is clear, and in an application guidance, when I looked into the new IFRS 9, I couldn't find that application guidance in there, but maybe I just missed it. But when I look into IS 16, and that's why I strongly believe we have to look at the definition of cost, IS 16 says that every consideration given to acquire an asset is cost. Now, for what else reason would I give the considered consideration to the seller? What else did he give to me? What am I doing this payment for?
So which also has a constraint about the timing
up to
which
I'm not trying to come up with a conclusion before, and I think we should have the discussion, and if the majority of things it goes for P&L, that's fine. But I think, and I agree with Jean about this and also Luca, that we have to look at the definition of cost, because it might give you a different answer to IS 39. And as you rightly pointed out, 16 is a cost-based standard. IFRS 3, the new one, obviously not. So I can understand that IFRS 3, you can come up with a different solution. So I'm not 100% sure that the decision is already clear. And if it is clear, and all the committee members said, yes, everything goes to P&L after the liability, then I guess we don't have to go on. We just have a conclusion and say, well, the standard is clear. We don't need an interpretation. Well, at least I'm not convinced that the answer is clear.
Balance?
Yes. I hear the argument that is made. It is a financial liability. Changes in financial liability go to P&L. I think we need to go beyond that, because before IFRIC 1 was issued, you had IS 37. And IS 37 was saying every change in a provision should go into P&L. And then IFRIC, supported by the board, decided, no, there is a case with decommissioning liabilities where a change in a provision can go into the cost of an asset. So this is why I'm saying, in this case, obviously the easy answer is to say, oh, financial liabilities or P&L. I'm asking to reconsider the situation and to go further, one step further. Yes, we have a financial liability. IS 39 effectively will tell you to go to P&L, but is it the right answer? Is it providing meaningful information about what you are purchasing? And I think then I encounter once more a familiar situation where you would be faced with a purchase of an asset whose nature we have to be confirmed with the future events. And so you have a liability up front, which is going to be changing. And so as soon as IFRS confirms that what you have purchased is effectively worth more, but you agreed to pay for it when you decided to purchase it, you are going to recognize a loss in P&L, whereas it's just confirmation of what you had agreed to pay. And I think that the outcome would be absolutely counterintuitive, once more, to have a loss that does not reflect what you have purchased. So this is why I would ask the committee members just not to focus IS 39 as it is, but to go beyond and look at what do we want to achieve, what is the financial reporting we want to have that is meaningful, that is good financial reporting. And if we believe that it has to go beyond what the committee can do, we need to involve the board.
Laurence, if you go back to our constitution and our due process, you will find that what you're aiming to do is something that is way beyond the scope of what this committee can do. We don't have a responsibility to generally improve financial reporting, to produce meaningful information where standards are already written that have followed full due process and been confirmed by the board that describe to you how you should account for transactions. We can deal with issues that come up. Somebody is asking us for an interpretation of how now to apply IS 16 to determine the cost of things with contingent pricing built in. We cannot ignore the existing standards. And whether some people think they're not as clear as they might be, we still have to take account of where those standards sit. Let me give you one example, because the majority of you don't want to restrict the scope. What that means is that when we start talking about cost, we have to talk about every element of cost. The item that at the moment Andrew described as a subsequent development to something that was already appropriate for its existing use as an office building, but then you want to change it and do something else. IS 16 deals with that at the moment, subsequent expenditure, and how that should be accounted for. Now you're saying within the scope of this project, we have to determine if in fact that was contingent on the original acquisition or not, and if there was any link, any contingency, that we have to deal with it within the scope of this. So I'll give you a simple example, and I'm indebted to Philippe for raising this with me at an earlier stage. You have decided that you're going to buy your painting, and you're going to pay not in euros, because the seller isn't interested in euros, he wants Japanese yen, very sensibly, because that's where a lot of the wealth is these days, Tak. This is in deference to you. And the contingency, therefore, is that you will pay the additional amount in Japanese yen. Now, the question arises, is that an obligation that you have at the outset? If it's an obligation that you have at the outset, and it's a foreign currency liability, what do we normally do if you've agreed to buy something with no contingency, but that the payment is in foreign currency and it takes place at some time later? I would guess you would say the change in the foreign exchange rate and the implication of that is accounted for in profit and loss. Now you're saying, okay, because the scope is so wide, we now have to consider what portion of that foreign exchange gain or loss is now related to the cost of the asset, related to the contingency, and let's write a complex interpretation, something that is even more complex than IFRIC 12, and you know how long that took to produce. Can I suggest, Fabienne, if you're at peace with us, that we proceed to the second part of your paper and maybe we can give you some positive answers on it.
So turning on to the possible accounting treatments. The staff notes, we have already said a lot of what I'm going to say again, but the staff know that contingent prices are usually contractual and settled in cash. Consequently, they meet the definition of financial instruments. The staff know that the timing of recognition of the contingent price as an element of the costs of the asset purchased is dependent on the recognition of the related financial liability. The staff recall from the discussions in January that there was general agreement among the committee members not to recognize the liability on the date of purchase unless there was an obligation that could not be avoided to deliver cash to settle the contingent price as at that date. Talking about initial recognition, the staff note that contingent prices are financial instruments, therefore they follow the financial instruments standards. Those standards are silent on the accounting for the corresponding entry, i.e. the debit, upon initial recognition of financial liability. The staff believe that a contingent price that is an element of the cost of the asset purchased should adjust the cost of the asset purchased upon the recognition of the liability. Turning to subsequent measurements, the financial instrument standards, as we already noted, require that the changes in the measurement of the liability be recognized in profit or loss. As for the analogies to other IFRSs that were discussed in January, the staff note that analogizing to existing IFRS literature would indeed enhance consistency within IFRS. However, the differences in accounting models raise difficulties that interpretive guidance would not be able to solve, such as the accounting for transaction-related costs and other matters. So maybe the first question on for you on the analogy is, do you agree that IFRS 91 should not be analogized to with respect to the accounting for contingent prices?
Peter?
I'm struggling with, well, first of all, maybe Bob, I don't share your problems with the example that you just had, because as I proposed before, we should just define contingent consideration as it's laid down in IFRS 3, and your Japanese yen example would not fit into this contingent consideration. So we could narrow the scope, not including this example. The problem that I have with not analogizing to IFRIC 1 is, if the only reason that we have is that AG8 and IS 39, and I'm still trying to find where this application guidance is in the new IFRS 9. I couldn't find it yet, but maybe I've overseen it anyway. Based on the grounds that we say, well, there is an AG8 in IS 39 that tells you you should charge changes to a financial liability to P&L, and because it's a contractual financial obligation, a payment that is made to the seller, as compared to a non-contractual obligation, a payment that is not made to the seller, but this non-contractual payment is part of the acquisition cost of an asset. And the other thing that I'm paying to the seller, who's not providing me any other service, and that's a presumption that I make, would also narrow the scope, then this is not part of the acquisition cost. Sorry, that's not convincing to me. And I was trying to read IFRIC 1, but I was too slow. I was trying to find out why picking up Dawes' view before, why the committee came to the solution that these kind of costs provision is part of the acquisition cost of an asset. And maybe that's where we would have to look at. And again, I think that I agree that AG8 tells you that you should charge it to P&L. But the way I read IS 16 is that everything that you are paying to the seller in order to acquire an asset is acquisition cost. So there might be a problem that we cannot resolve. I agree. Maybe the board has to look at it. But I think we are making it for us too simple to just say, well, look at AG8, here's the answer, that's it.
But that's why Fabienne was focusing on the cost of the asset originally and not the discussion about the liability. That if we can agree on what the cost of the asset should be, and then we find that there is a conflict within IFRS, that one other standard, 39, prohibits or does not appear to permit that, then that's an issue that we can raise with the board and say something needs to be fixed. But we have to focus, and I think that's what Fabienne wanted, on how do we determine what is the cost of the assets and what's the best basis of doing that?
Because it may be that some people have the view that these costs have to be incurred as at the transaction date. And if you're not showing a liability as at the acquisition date because you can influence the payment of this liability, then it has not been incurred as at the transaction date. That might be a view that is taken by some of the members. So I think at least from this perspective, we would need to look at whether a liability is recognized or not.
Again, I think the way that Fabienne had built this up, that it was on the basis that if you had incurred that liability, if you had incurred those costs, not at the transaction date, but at the on or before the date on which the asset was capable of being brought into production or was ready for its intended use, then she was thinking there's a clear indication that those costs would be included in the cost of the asset. It didn't, by presumption, mean that costs or a liability that hadn't been incurred at the time that the asset was brought into a condition for use would be excluded from incrementing the cost of the asset on a subsequent occasion. That's a different consideration. And that wasn't the question that we wanted to look at in contingent consideration. But the request that you've said is that we now have to consider contingent consideration in the form where there is a pre-existing liability and contingent consideration where the obligation only arises subsequent to the date on which the asset is brought into use. You're wanting us to look at both of those issues. And the answers could be different because the circumstances are different. Okay. Scott?
I think the question that we've been asked right now is, should we analogize to IFRS 3 and IFRIC 1? That's going to generate discussion along a number of paragraphs. I alluded earlier to my concern about the contingencies where the purchaser has some measure of control, and the easiest one is a contingency based on future sales, future EBITDA, future gross margin, future use of the asset, where the purchaser could, in theory, just decide to go out of business and not have any future sales, or to not use the asset. And the seeming suggestion that therefore any payment that does result from such use or such sales couldn't be part of the cost of the asset because it wasn't incurred. And I guess that is the area that raises significant concern for me. I look to the basis for conclusions of IFRS 3 regarding contingent consideration, and although I can understand not analogizing to IFRS 3 specifically, the basis for conclusions regarding contingent consideration says both boards concluded that delayed recognition of contingent consideration in their previous standards was unacceptable because it ignored that the acquirer's agreement to make contingent payments is the obligating event in a business combination. Would not that agreement to make contingent payments be an obligating event in an acquisition of an asset? I don't see how what you're purchasing changes whether the agreement to make contingent payments is an obligating event. And so to me, we have a liability to record when we have agreed to make contingent payments. There's no way out of that obligation. Yes, we could not have any sales, and we would then fulfill our obligation without making a payment. But we have no discretion to avoid the obligation. If there are sales, we make the payment. And so I would have thought that we weren't analogizing to IFRS 3, rather we were looking to the same guidance that IFRS 3 looked to decide that agreement to make contingent payments results in the need to record a liability. Having recorded that liability, I would think the other side of that entry would be cost. And we do have a discussion about future changes in the liability that we need to have. But as drafted, when the contingency is future sales or future activity that
you know, the seller can decide not to have that activity, we would always have zero going into the cost of the asset. And that's where I have significant concern, because I've seen plenty of asset purchases where the cost of the asset would be zero. I'm buying the rights to intellectual property, and the payment is $1 for each of the first 1 million times I use it. And from then on, I use it for free. Well, it's mine, so I don't really have to pay anything to use my own technology. Well, I think the cost is zero as this is drafted, but I think in real life, people would usually think the cost of that is $1 million. I'm just going to pay it later. Now, if there was some chance that you would never get to $1 million, then, you know, we'd have debates about whether the fair value is something less than that, and you should only record 800,000 as the cost of the asset based on a fair value estimate. But I don't think anybody's recording that at zero these days, and I understand why they wouldn't record that at zero. I then took this a little bit further, and paragraph 56 says there's no liability in the situation when it's in the purchaser's control. And I thought, well, what if in exchange for agreeing to pay 3% of my future sales, that wasn't part of the purchase price of an asset, I just got cash for that. And that's a legitimate financing technique that companies use. If we say there's no liability in that instance, then upon Citibank paying us in exchange for 3% of our future sales, we record, I guess, income, which that doesn't feel right either. So I guess my significant concern is over the seeming conclusion that we can't possibly be recording a liability when it's within the purchaser's control and therefore couldn't have any cost to the asset.
3219 tells you so. You have an obligation. That's actually the same problem that I have, but it's in 3219, and I would agree with Scott. I would say it's part of the acquisition cost because I'm paying it to the seller. But 3219 tells you that you may have a contractual obligation. Yes, you may have an obligation. But as long as you do have an unconditional right to avoid, you don't have a liability. So there are two steps, obligation, liability.
I don't think you have an unconditional right to avoid.
We can discuss about that, but that's the issue we are dealing with here.
But we can discuss that offline, because I just remind you that there's the other thing, because we're dealing with the cost of the asset, which Ruth reminded us of earlier, which is that the cost of an asset is the price that you have paid, and it includes the fair value of the consideration, other consideration. Fair value of other consideration would say, in the circumstances you've described, you may not have, or it may be within your control not to make any sales. However, the assessment of the fair value of that promise to pay $1 per unit of sales for the first million would be something that would have more than a zero fair value. And therefore, you would have a cost in here.
I'm with you there. I just didn't think that the write-up was going to get you to that point. I thought the write-up was getting you to zero in that situation.
Well, some of you are saying, of course, that you don't like what's written in the standards and you would like different accounting, and perhaps that's also what Fabienne was anticipating. But let's keep going. Andrew, you're next.
Well, just coming back to the point that Guido made, I think, I might be wrong, but I think IFRIC 1 was able to do what it was able to do because IS-30 is based on 37, and 37 tells you how to recognise and measure a provision, but it doesn't tell you how to deal with the other side of the entry. And I think that's the difference with IS-39.
Are you sure?
I'm not sure.
I'll tell you what, we'll ask Laurence to check on that whilst we go around the room. Are you checking on? It's your turn next.
Yeah, so Jean-Louis will help me. But so on question two. Yeah, it is.
Okay, question three, Fabienne.
On question two, for the records, my prior comments.
made you clear that I'm not convinced by the arguments that have been made, that you should read I-69 only one way and that you should not analogize to...
question on question two, I think, is I-Forest 3 or IFRIC 1.
Yeah, and so what I'm saying is I don't buy the arguments to say IFRIC 1 cannot be looked at as a precedent. Responding to Scott's comments about the existence of a liability when an entity has discretion whether to pay or not, and we started to touch on it at the January's meeting, particularly with the topics of economic compulsion. And I do recall that this issue has been discussed at length, and in particular at the Interpretation Committee. And it was concluded in the case of financial instruments that economic compulsion is not something to consider in order to decide whether you should recognize a financial liability or not. So I have this as a basis to agree with the staff that when liability is at the discretion of the purchaser, you don't recognize a liability. I also agree with the staff when the staff says that when you have an element that is not linked to the item that you are purchasing, that you account for it separately, such as a derivative.
And now, Jean-Louis, on the IS-87, have you found something?
Jean-Louis can wait his turn.
Hello, I'm on IFRIC 1.
Oh, you're on IFRIC 1.
It's reading slowly. Okay. Ruth?
Yes, just to go back to the staff question on analogizing, should we be analogizing to IFRS 3 or IFRIC 1? I'm kind of with Scott here. I'm very worried about saying there's no obligation because I can avoid having to pay anything. I could shut down my business. Anybody could say that about anything. That worries me, and I hear what Laurent said about economic compulsion, but I think we have to look at, and maybe this answers the question, which one do we look at first, the asset or the liability? If we look at the asset first, and we are required to include the fair value of the consideration, and that includes an estimate of the contingent consideration, then you have to book something on the credit side. What else would you do? So I share Scott's concerns, and I'm worried that we'd come up with nothing on the asset side if we said there's no liability, where there'd be many cases where the purchaser would be able to argue that it's within its control to avoid paying because it could shut down its business. I've seen that happen in practice. So I would rather go with the analogy to IFRS 3 because I think there is some sound argument in there. And I think it fits with IS 16 quite comfortably to say that at the date of acquisition, the cost is the fair value of the consideration to acquire the asset, and that includes an estimate of the contingency. And that gets you some cost into the asset, that gets you a liability, and then we're left with, well, what do I do with the changes in the value of the liability?
Michael?
Just a couple of things that you were saying there, Ruth. I hear exactly what you're saying about what I 16 says about the cost of the asset is both the cash transferred plus the fair value of the consideration, and that could lead you to recognise that fair value of the contingent consideration. But when you say, yes, it's okay to analogise to IFRS 3, what about those other aspects of IFRS 3, such as the prohibition on including transaction costs within the cost of assets? Isn't that a difficulty then?
I wasn't going to call IFRS 3 applying. I'm saying the principle of IFRS 3 as to what is included in my cost.
Okay.
That's all. To the extent that it fits with IS 16, which I think it does, in a single asset acquisition, that's all I meant.
Presumably, if... In fact, you are taking into account the fair value of something over which the purchaser had the right to decide not to do something, then that would be reflected in its fair value at a lower amount than if they had no control.
Yes.
So it would be taken into consideration, but it's not a binary consideration. Okay, Aaron.
For fear of not being allowed back in the United States, let me say that I agree with the French.
Sorry, you misunderstood. That means you would never be allowed back in these hallowed
shores. You were allowed back in the U.S. That was it.
Exactly. I knew my purchase of French wine would come in handy. I think there, again, to the staff's question, I believe there's room in the standards to analogize either to 3 or to IFRIC 1. My preference, again, would be an analogy to IFRIC 1. I think that would provide, I think an ARO is very similar to what we're talking about here, and again, back to the original comment of deferred payments versus future operating losses or future operating costs. So just to be very succinct, I think there is room in the standard for the IFRIC to choose, or the IFRS, I see, to choose how it wants to analogize. My preference would be for IFRS 1, or IFRIC 1.
Yes, Your Honor.
I think question 2, in terms of the analogy, I think we are giving, if you like, we're answering 2 different questions, because there is analogy in terms of what is the cost, and then there is analogy in terms of how you deal with the liability and subsequent measurement of the liability. And I think that Scott and Ruth have talked about the analogy in terms of recognizing the cost of an asset, and I would agree with that, but to me that's not actually how I read question 2, and I think where Fabienne is actually getting to is around the liability side, and I wouldn't analogize to either of those, I must admit, in terms of, because I think that both of them are, and it comes back to, so fundamentally different, assuming it is an IFRS 9, and I didn't actually look, Guido, but AG 8 in IAS 39, again, comes back to, I don't think we can analogize to 3 or 1 in relation to the actual liability, because we have another standard that says the opposite, and that is different than in relation to the asset. And I think we need to be clear as to when we're talking about analogize, as to whether we're talking about the recognition of the asset or we're talking about the recognition and measurement of the subsequent of the liability.
Okay. The fortunate thing that Fabienne is able to do, of course, is use the word analogize without being restricted like a preparer or an auditor in analogize in the sense of all of the IFRSs, as opposed to analogize to the solution that is proposed within that standard to develop the interpretation that we would want. If you could analogize clearly, then there would be no need for an interpretation. Jean-Louis? No, have you found the elusive paragraph in 37?
In 57, in paragraph 59, it says provision shall be reviewed at the end of each reporting period adjusted to reflect the current best estimate. If it is no longer probable that an outflow of resources will be required to settle the obligation, the provision shall be reversed. So the only situation which is considered is a full reversal of the provision, but not clearly a partial reversal. As far as IFRIC 1 is concerned, it's very clear in paragraph 5 that any adjustment of the liabilities is reflected in the asset.
Yeah, I agree. That was my understanding of it as well. But apart from 61, that you can't use that provision for anything else, but we're speaking specifically here. I would read the requirement that you reverse a provision if it's not required as being that you adjust the item that originally gave rise to that, and in the sense of an asset that gave a rise to the provision, then if there's a provision the contingency didn't eventuate, then you would adjust the asset downwards, and it would seem to be appropriate symmetrically, therefore, to say that, and if the provision increases, that the increase could be considered to go to the cost of the asset, which would be fine if the liability was a 37 liability. But that, I think, is what people were looking at under the previous analogy to contingent consideration, and that was the accounting outcome. So there is a basis in there, and it is something that the French and the French Canadians and the French New Yorkers all have a preference towards. Incidentally, if you've got a case of French wine, I just checked that it hasn't come from Quebec, because there is some question about its authenticity there. Sorry, Ruth, did you have another point?
I wanted to clarify what Joanna was saying is when I was speaking about analogy to IFRS 3, I was talking about initial recognition. And they are two separate questions. I didn't think we'd got onto question two yet, which was, well, now if we've managed to find a liability and book it, and we've agreed we can book it against the asset, which I'm not sure we've even got there yet, but if we have, then we move on to, well, how do I remeasure? What happens if I remeasure the liability?
Okay. Despite the fact that I was concerned about the scope of this project, I mean, we don't have to come to a conclusion on everything today. We can leave something over to reflect on for next time. But what I'm hearing coming back from the committee is in answer to question two, IFRS 3, and particularly the basis for conclusions, rather than the standard itself, has some very descriptive words about when you have an obligation and what the obligating event is that gives rise to a liability and the requirement to measure that liability. That seems to be then consistent with the IAS 16 requirement to measure the value of other consideration that is issued, which would be in line with contingent consideration, and to include that in the cost of the asset. So I think if we put those two pieces together, then that gives us something for the initial recognition at the time that that obligation is created, and whether the obligation is something fulfillment of which is under or outside the control of the purchaser is more a question for the measurement of the obligation rather than the determination of the recognition of the obligation, I think is the basis on which we proceed. I read your question as being a little bit broader as to also what we do, though, subsequently about remeasurement. Is that your intention, or as in IFRIC 1 remeasurement deals with things by adjusting the asset, IFRS 3 subsequent changes go to profit and loss? That's what you really want us to say in 2, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
And I've heard a number of people comment, not always when we were talking about this question, that they would prefer to see something that where payments are made as a consequence of this obligation to the supplier of the asset, that those are considered to be, or intuitively would be considered to be, part of the cost of that asset, very broadly. You're not going to disagree with me, are you?
No. This is one way to see it, which would be a very simple way to see it. Everything that I paid to the supplier is part of the cost, and I could read it from IAS 16. I think the reasoning for the board in IFRS 3, when I looked into BC 357, to charge that to P&L is that these changes do not depict the asset or the business that I've acquired as at the transaction date, but something else happened afterwards. So another way to define acquisition costs might be not everything that I pay to the seller, but everything that is some kind of a non-adjusting event that happens after the transaction date that just gives me a better estimate of the value of the cost of the asset as at the transaction date. And everything else is then not part of the acquisition cost. Now, I think that's a better answer, but I think it will be hard for us to sort out what is adjusting and non-adjusting. So
it'd be hard because you insisted that we didn't restrict the scope.
Yes.
So now we've got to deal with all of these issues.
Because I wanted to have
that, because that was your decision, that the committee will stand by it, then be prepared for the difficulties.
Yes. I'm sorry for that, but I think some more interesting discussions coming.
You're bringing joy and happiness to someone somewhere in this world. All right, Fabienne.
Shangan.
Do you have any questions to clarify where we are on question two?
I think that's.
You have some issues that you've got to think about and bring analysis back at the next meeting, But we're trying to give you some broad steer on the direction we want to follow on these accounting issues. Guido will give you some help. Is there anything on question three that we haven't already inadvertently answered for you?
I think we've done those key points in 79, paragraph 79 of the paper. Well, I think that's we've covered it all.
Okay. All right. Is there anything else that you feel would... Jean-Louis?
About subsequent variation of the liability, that which, if we are going the 39 way, sometimes we may have a variable part which is specific to the entity that would be scoped out of 39. So I think that if the variable part is, for example, is sale turnover, which is specific to the entity, the buying entity, I think it might be scoped out.
That you're referring to the definition of a derivative,
yeah,
and that, yes, that would be scoped out of the definition of derivative, but I don't think it would be excluded from the scope of a financial liability, so I think it would still be in. It just wouldn't qualify as a derivative.
The effect would be different. Yep.
Yes, so instead of fair value accounting, it's amortized cost accounting.
Okay, that's my point.
Okay. Oh, sorry, Ruth.
I just wanted to confirm that we really do want to expand the scope. I mean, I know a number of people said they did. Personally, I'm not in favour of it. I think we need to focus on these critical issues first, and I think it would be more efficient for the staff to focus on a limited scope to start with and address the critical issues that we've highlighted rather than going too broad too quickly.
The direction that we've got from here is, at this stage, not to restrict the scope. So that's the advice of the staff, is to aim to go wide. The staff, in their analysis, if they feel that to address the full scope would be too much to deal with in the papers for the next round, then the staff will come back and recommend to us that we consider this part still within our context of the very broad scope, and perhaps make some constructive suggestions as to why there are certain things that we shouldn't be looking at, or alternatively, why the things that they're bringing in the paper are the only things that we should look at. I mean, this first meeting is really to try and give some direction to the staff to assist them in their analysis, not to make their life more difficult. And if, despite the good advice that we give them, they feel that there is a more efficient way of doing it, then it's my experience, Michael, that the staff is sensible enough,
of course,
to do the right thing.
We will.
Yeah. John.
I wonder, Bob, at this point it's a bit confusing where we stand with all these comments, and I wonder if the idea will not be to investigate whether there can be a conflict between the cost model and IAS 39 as an intermediate step. To define, you know, whether on a straight purchase, nothing complicated with a contingent payment, whether we can identify, in this simplified situation, a conflict between 39 and the cost model. And if we could identify, I think we may very well identify a conflict. And then that could help us to define what we want to do with this. That will be quite a fundamental issue that we have to reflect on it, because trying to define, you know, or to deal with all sorts of different situations and try to cover everything, let's step back and say, do we have a fundamental conflict? And at this moment, I think we might say yes.
Mm-hmm.
There's a fundamental conflict with it. What do we do with that? Is it worth then looking at all sorts of situation scenarios, or do we want to address this fundamental conflict at all?
I think the staff is going to come back with that, and maybe I wouldn't agree that it's a fundamental conflict, but there's certainly is a conflict between the apparent interpretation of the requirement of some standards and how they interact together. And again, the responsibility of this committee is to identify where there's a conflict and then to consider the best means of overcoming that conflict. And so to use the phrase of the week, which Laurence has suggested, that if the answer by following the standards is counterintuitive, so it doesn't assist in clear financial reporting, then we have a duty under the Constitution to report that to the board and to advise them of what we recommend to improve financial reporting. So we're not constrained by having to strictly stay within the confines of the standards as they are written. But as I was saying earlier, we can't ignore the standards that have been written. We're not starting from a blank sheet of paper. So if we find that there is a conflict and we find that this issue of changes in a financial liability must go through profit and loss, categorically no exceptions, and that we say, but that is just a complete nonsense in the following circumstances, then we have to be very persuasive in persuading the board that a change to the standards has to be made. We can interpret on our own. We need the board's approval to change the standard, or we need, in fact, not their approval. We need to persuade them of the reasons why they should change the standard, and then why our interpretation would continue. So I don't rule out that we can make some recommendations to overcome these conflicts, but we have to be sure that it's the right accounting. Andrew?
Well, I really just wanted to be sure what direction we had given to the staff as a result of the discussion we've had. I heard what you said about scope, but am I right in assuming that we're veering towards IFRS 3 by analogy and intuitively payments to the vendor or go to the cost of the asset? Is that the direction we've given the staff?
Well, that doesn't sound like an analogy to IFRS 3. That sounds like a hybrid.
That's why I'm slightly confused as to what direction we have.
But the taking IFRS 3 for initial recognition,
right,
different, that there is an obligating event. Scott was very kind to read out the particular reference earlier, why that was persuasive, and that seems difficult to fly in the face. So we'll accept that as a basis, that if there is currently an obligation, that you should recognize that obligation. Equally, as Ruth had pointed out in IS 16, that there's a requirement to look at the other consideration at fair value in determining part of the cost of the asset. So that would tell us where to put the debit entry from that credit that's going to be recognized. That deals with initial recognition. So we've used IFRS 3 and IS 16 for that start point. We then have to say, now what happens when the liability changes? And what I'm hearing you say, not necessarily with the full authority of IFRS, but there are pieces of IFRS to which you would like to incorporate into an interpretation or an amended standard that are similar to IFRIC 1 in dealing with changes in an estimated provision for decommissioning or rehabilitation costs, in which the changes to that obligation, which result in payments, in this particular case to the supplier of the PP&E or the intangible asset, those payments under certain conditions would also be included in the cost of the asset. So that's moving into, as it were, uncharted territory to some extent, but it's not a million miles removed from what the practice used to be of analogizing to the old contingent consideration under the now withdrawn IFRS 3. And people, of course, as we know, can't analogize to standards that no longer exist, much as they like the answer. Is that okay? Do you want to take a break now, or do you want to continue?